Okay, Alan, let me start with my first question, and that is relating to our email conversation at the begin. When I asked you to have an interview with you, you said, please don't ask this question. What is the essence of Filipino literature? And I probably know what you mean. I mean, you can never say probably there is one literature, it's so diverse. Yes. And is this what you wanted to tell me? I mean, that you can't put it on a point?
But aside from that, we already have several textbooks on that very same topic, right? It's Philippine Literature, History, and Anthology by Binbini de Lumbera and other such like textbooks. So I think other people already did that kind of very exhaustive work. So I'm just asking that please do not put that kind of burden again to our shoulders, and you can just go directly to the textbooks and read, because anyway, it's just a matter of surveying right? Yeah. a very large bulk of written works.
That is true, and when I mean the few stories we had published from Filipino authors, I mean they are so different to each other. That I got so excited because I like diverse literature. Yes. Literature that is so different from each other, and I didn't expect it when delving into Filipino literature that it's such a complex issue. I mean, you always start with Rizal, whom I read, and then you suddenly are in the present. And what I found interesting about your approach is, I mean, I have a social anthropology background. I did a lot of field research in Central and Eastern Africa, collecting stories, oral history. Mm-hmm. And when I look at your approach, and I met a PhD scholar two nights ago, and he said one of his favorite books, number 3 of all Filipino literature, is Aswanglaut.
Okay.
Yeah, so he was really excited. He said, this author is just amazing because he manages to really get the old mythology to the present. And I wonder why and how did you start with this approach towards literature? I mean, how did it come? I mean, not many people are going. I mean, many, even now, Filipino science fiction authors, they take, of course, something from the old myth and mythology, but you are much more into it. So when did it start and why did it start?
Because the ambition really is coming from a creative writing program to delve into fantasy, but I reached a point when I realized that writing fantasy, especially in Filipino context, should be grounded not merely on imaginings, but I think solid studies, research, and the best place to go to would be ethnohistory, anthropology, and folklore studies. I think in my memory, the germinal would be in this kind of formation would be when I was attending a fiction writing class. It was supposed to be a creative writing class, but my fiction writing professor, Pedro Jun Cruz Reyes, brought out a book in the class, and it's not a manual on good fiction writing. It's not even a novel or something that we consider nowadays as literary. It's rather a history book, a Philippine history book, a history book that focuses on the pre-colonial part of our story. That book is particularly titled Barangay by this very famous American historian, William Henry Scott. Mm-hmm. I think my professor during that time, Jun Cruz Reyes, became a big fan of William Henry Scott, and he introduced Scott to us, the book, and the possibility of using ethnohistory as a source and an influence to our writings. I think it all began that day, that one afternoon in that class.
Uh-huh. And you've gone a long way. I mean, you go to villages and you talk to the elders who do this chanting, or
yes.
And with the chanting they transform, or they tell the oral history of the community.
Yes. So from, how would I say, should I say just writing fiction? I don't know if it's correct for me to say that. I think one direction that I pursued is the path that is more of anthropological
yeah.
interest. So the anthropology part did not just, to me, became a some sort of like inspiration or starting point, or just a means to do your creative stuff. But somewhere along the way, anthropology, that kind of scholarship, that kind of exploration also became somehow an end in itself. So that is why, aside from writing this kind of short stories, I do my own field work. I do what you can say ethnographic studies.
Yeah, but you do transform these recordings, I mean these transcripts, aren't you? I mean, because even in this text you sent to us and we published, I saw something, I mean always some related sentences to the present.
Yes.
So there are always some bits that it's kind of an anchor to our present. So you amend these
yes. I really have to do that, because it's clear to me that this project, like Aswang Laut and Tungkong Langit and Alunsina
yeah.
Story, they're fiction and therefore retellings or reimaginings of these folklores. But I do also delve into the more scholarly kind of writing, and every now and then I do attend these academic conferences. So it's
yeah.
a really kind of a different world with a different interest, a different framing. But of course, fiction would always be like a home to me, and it's a very exciting place to be as a space that you can consider home.
Yeah, and what I was, I mean, when I met this scholar, this PhD scholar, I mean, he was really excited about your way, your approach. And I wonder, what are these old stories and myths telling us in the present? I mean, what are they, why are they still important? What would you say to tell them, to reenact them in our present? I was surprised, I mean, because this is very, very unique in my way. I haven't seen something like this, for example, in German literature. We have these old fairy tales and which are part of the this old oral history, of course, but not like this. So what would you, why do you think it is still important for young people to read it? I mean, what do they read in that? What is it, what kind of things is, what do they gain from it?
Especially nowadays that we are very much, I think, concerned and very much worried about how climate change is affecting and changing our environment. These myths came from a society that is very much attuned with nature, with environment, and it's this kind. It shows this kind of world perspective where humans are not really that much separate from other forms of creations.
Yeah,
that's why I think the myths. These myths would still be relevant because it's
a kind of blueprint to our present, how to be united with, in a way of kind of the nature, Mother Earth, or
yes,
whichever way you would like to express it. And would you say that it helps as a kind of identity building as well? I mean, because I think this country is split in so many languages, and I think what I've so far read that it is still of importance if you write in English or if you write in one of your mother tongues. I mean, it's and it is still a division. I mean, it's still a divided country in this respect. So, and would you say that these myths, to bring them up, helps on another level to build identity?
Yes, but the thing with identity in Filipino context is much more complex because we are an archipelago to start with, right?
Yeah.
And before there was no idea of a nation.
Yeah.
So we live as separate families. The basic unit of society would be kinship, and of course you have the barangay and the entire island. So it is a context wherein the idea of otherness is really very strong, considering that we have several indigenous group that when you look at the name that they would give to their own group, okay, it's the name might sound so indigenous to you, but it only means human. Like, I think one example perhaps would be Manobo, okay, from Mindanao, so an indigenous group from Mindanao. But if you study the meaning of the word, the etymology of the word, it just means human. So if a group is calling itself human, but it is aware that there are other beings on the other side of the island that looks like them, so we would now wonder, so if they're human, what would they call those people out there who doesn't belong to their group? So alienation and otherness was really, I think, quite strong during that time. So, and I think that's also part of being in an archipelago. So you look at other groups as always a constant enemy, or they're just a tribe that you can do your raiding, your attack, your right, and they're just there to become your slaves in the future. When you attack them when you become successful in your raiding, and it's to them it's normal. It's the thing. It's how you live. Okay, so with myths, and usually we say mythology, I think, strictly speaking, you don't really have Philippine mythology. I think none such. If by mythology, we are thinking in terms of like how Edith Hamilton studied Greek mythology and thought about Greek mythology as something that you can systematize. So it's a pantheon of gods and stories that can be put in a single book because they can be systematized and connected in some way. But I think you don't do that with our myths.
There is no, because it's too fragmented. I mean, yes, because of all these islands, because of this island situation, they most of these groups never had contact to each other, so they developed their own myth.
Yes.
And these myths are they really different to each other? I mean, in a significant way. I mean, are they the creation of the earth or whatever? I mean, is this really, or is there some kind of pattern that is repeated?
Well, there are, of course, similarities, because after all, we're talking about archetypes, tropes, and motifs, which could be sometimes, or most of the times, quite universal. So I would say that it's vary. One myth, one region's myth from the other could be a variation. Mm. Of maybe the same myth, which is an older myth, perhaps. But as a rule, there are no crossovers.
Okay.
So like the stories of the gods from, let's say, the Bicol myth.
Yeah.
Okay, so these characters might interact from divine beings from the next town or the next village, like maybe a certain character would have a crossover from Albay Bicol to Naga Bicol, but because they're of the same peninsula, so that's quite understandable. But you don't get to see these characters, let's say, in the Visayas. Usually that never happens.
All right, but so you don't have characters like this Aswang, how would he call it?
Yeah, but
this is a concept, I don't know, a concept of evil, or and because I've talked to a science fiction author yesterday, a very young one, and she is bringing all this Aswang thing into a kind of future of Manila, and a kind of robot thing, yeah. And we published a story by this Bicol writer. Oh, what's his name?
Christian Cordero?
Christian Cordero. And of course, there the Aswang is really strong. I mean, it's a story about about the raids against the communists under Marcos, and of course, this Aswang is there present. And so I was really wondering, wow, she's having it in her science fiction story. He is having it. Is this characters like this? Are they in a way? Are there similarities? If you look at it.
That's why I think the Aswang imaginary is special, because he would be, or she would be, the exception.
Interesting.
When I said that the divine beings are exclusive to their own regions. Because once upon a time, Aswang was also a deity.
Like the devil in Christian belief, so it's always come from the good side, and
yes, he was a friend with the chief god, at least in the Bicol myth, he's a friend of, and also in some versions, not just a friend but also a brother to the chief god, who his name Gugurang. Okay, but they guarded these two mountains. Gugurang, who is supposed to be the good god, was the guardian of the Mount Mayon, which is, as you know, the major mountain in Bicol and also in the Philippines. Okay, and the other less prestigious mountain, the Mount Malinaw, is guarded by Aswang. And in many stories, with or without Aswang, these two mountains are considered to be rival. mountains.
Oh, interesting.
So when Aswang, who is some kind of a deity and a demi or a demigod, lost to Gugurang because of that fight, and when Gugurang destroyed Mount Malinaw, in some versions, some Bicolanos would say Gugurang transferred from Mount Malinaw, which is in Albay, to Mount Asog, which is in Naga already. So you have that physical crossing of a deity, which, as I have said, does not happen every day now in our story. So he, Aswang, changed headquarter.
All right, but in his story, Aswang is somewhere. It seems that there are many Aswangs.
I mean, yes.
Many women-like, men-like, and they are trying to hunt humans at special times of night or whatever.
Yes.
So it's not only a deity, but it can split into many sub-personalities.
Yes.
Okay. That's
so this Bicol Aswang I've told you about is very different because as an archetype, he is a demigod or a god that battles against the good god. But later in folk stories, he would be diminished into a monster figure.
Oh,
so
okay.
Aswang is really very interesting because he is a character that is consists of many archetypes. So you can see him as a demigod. And as a demigod, he's believed to be the god of the underworld. And at the same time, he's also a trickster. And at the same time, he's also a monster. So that monster part has been the archetype that many Filipinos now are more familiar with.
I understand. And would you say that through colonial times and now modern times, that these mythologies, that these myths are diminishing? I mean, are they vanishing because of course, like in our place in the Western world, all these old myths have faded away in many ways and have been taken over by this new kind of myths by TikTok and Instagram, are of course another matter. But it's a transformation, I would say, in my area. But what about here? Is this happening as well?
Yes, of course. When you go to the communities and talk to the people themselves, so these people who believe in the existence of a real Aswang would tell you that their times have already gone by. So they would open up to you and say that it's quite different. Before, they really believed to be something as real and pervasive as your next door neighbors.
Yeah, that's okay.
But their times have already gone by, and when you ask them for the reasons, the first reason would be Christianity. There are already Christian churches, Catholic churches all around, and then second is the highway. Okay, so you would only have these kinds of stories in a certain kind of place where forests are just nearby.
Yeah.
Okay, but if you have a community that's already been densified by so many populations, so an Aswang would not thrive in that kind of place.
Oh, that's interesting. So with this change of with modernity, the vanishing of forests, of course, the habit that the Aswang needs is gone, and so the kind of concept is gone as well.
Yes, a very interesting interview I had. Again, in somewhere in Bicol, was this? She's supposed to be a healer, okay, and therefore, you would expect her to have the quote unquote spiritual eyes to see mystical things, and yes, she does. But when I asked her about the aswang, she said, let's not talk about them because there's no more point in talking about them. And I asked why, and she just answered, because they all died.
Really?
Okay, so it just so happened that you came late. The last aswang family in this place died like several years ago. But we know them. I know the father, I know the daughter. So they would explain that kind of passing away of a certain era in that very concrete manner, and that's also kind of amazing.
How interesting. That is really interesting. And while, because you've mentioned this kind of healers, I'm asking this because I did a long research on anti-witchcraft movements in Central Africa, and that means in times of crisis, these healers, female or male, were accused to be witches.
Yes.
and killed many times. And it was always in terms of crisis, when the tea prices fell or the global market changed. So this was reflected in the local communities because they didn't receive any more money and they were looking for reasons. And the reasons, the world economy, they didn't understand. So they took the local concept. So these are witches, they are to be blamed. And is this happening here as well? I mean, that these traditional healers are sometimes turned into, from something good into something bad?
Many historians would say that. Because in the Philippines, shamans here are called babaylans, especially in the Visayan regions, they're babaylans. In, I think, Western Visayas, they're called maaram. So from the word aram, alam, to know. In the northern part of Luzon, the Cordillera region, they're called mumbakis. And in many Tagalog regions, they're called Catalonans. So, yes, shamanism was alive during both the pre-colonial era and the Spanish colonial era. And many Filipino historians would say that during the Spanish colonization era, it was the babaylans who received that kind of brunt of these colonial activities, because in the first place, when the colonizers came here, it was the church that was weaponized and instrumentalized to realize that kind of colonial project. So the main project really is evangelism, conversions of these supposed to be pagan subjects into Christian subjects. Yeah. And therefore, the babaylans came in the way of that kind of supposed to be very smooth sailing project, colonial project. So they bear the brunt of the colonial violence, and first by they were the the contenders for the faith. So they were the ones who were demonized by the church to weaken this older religion, this animist religion. Mm-hmm. So one result of that demonization of these babaylans is the creation of this kind of aswang imaginary.
And nowadays, I mean, they're just healers, I mean, in these days.
Yes, there are. In some place, you could still find babaylans, and but there are very few, and I think some would call them albularios, but albularios are really technically not Babaylans, because the Babaylan would have a different social and political context, because the Babaylan during the pre-colonial era is quite powerful, because the chieftain is supposed to be by the right side of the chieftain, and usually the chieftain or the datu would ask the Babaylan for advice. So right. Technically
like the old Greek times, I mean, when you have these kind of oracles, I mean,
yes, okay. The Babaylan is supposed to be the advisor or the consultant. Yeah. So in that kind of setup, the Babaylan have real political power. But nowadays it's different with many of their the healers nowadays, they don't have that kind of status. So either you believe in them, so you go to them for healing, or people look at them as some kind of charlatans.
All right. So and they are not a part of this chanting. I mean, this is just done by the elders. I mean,
yes. Or, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and there are really very few epic chanters now.
It's sad, isn't it, somehow? I mean, you really have to hurry up to record them all, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yes, because I'm not sure if there would be a next generation of these epic chanters. So researchers in this kind of field are really working, I think, double time to record these chantings, as you've said.
Yeah, you really have to hurry up. I attended courses at a professor for Southern African, the Kwekwe, the Khoisan people, and he did record as well. And he said, this is the last generation. I mean, we have to fill our recordings and then to transcribe it to save it. I mean, it is because it's so... Yeah, it's so important to save these old mythologies because they still tell to us. I mean, they tell us stories that are important for our present.
Yes, we know of this French scholar who comes here in the Philippines every now and then. Her name is Nicole Rivel, and she specialized on the Palawan epics. And when she did a study, she was able to record, I think, one and made it into a book. It's called Kudaman. So the epic is titled Kudaman. But in the introduction to her book, she said that there are still many epics, even only in Palawan. She's just talking about Palawan, the islands in Palawan. There are still so many epics yet unrecorded, yet unknown. So we have many epics that are recorded but not yet transcribed, or transcribed but not yet published. And still there are so many that are not yet recorded nor transcribed. So as if these texts are non-existent.
And is the government I mean, recognizing the importance of this? I mean, are they funding your work, for example?
At least in my part, because I'm working here in Ateneo de Manila University, and Ateneo is a private institution, at least I got a funding from them to write the novel. But it's a private funding.
Yeah, that's it's a private
yes.
funding.
And,
yeah.
But
yeah.
the translation is government funded.
Okay. But I mean, but beside that, I mean,
yes. Of course, there is funding. There is government funding. There are government institutions. But you know, it's really politics, right? And administrations change.
Yeah.
And everything would depend really on the present regime's agenda.
All right. Yeah, I understand. And then you have your everyday work here. I mean, you're teaching creative writing, isn't it?
Yes. Now, this semester, I'm teaching Philippine mythology for a creative writing class. And the rest is basic Filipino. I mean, here, basic Filipino is Filipino research.
That means language research, or?
No. They do their research on Philippine culture in right. Filipino language. So that's the...
Okay, kind of social anthropology course, more or less.
But the research is being asked from first year students. So it's
really
very basic, but they have to do it in Filipino. And we encourage them to write about Pinoy culture, specifically Pinoy pop culture, because we think that they're more attuned to that aspect of Philippine culture, the popular culture.
All right, that's interesting.
Okay, that's the idea.
And, okay.
So I teach that almost every day. But during Wednesdays, I do Philippine mythology. So it's really a very different paradigm.
And then these students that come to study these, why are they doing it? I mean, in my place, normally the parents would say, this is for nothing. You will never have a job with these kind of courses you take. In which way are the students driven? I mean, why are they taking these subjects?
Oh, but with the basic Filipino course, I wouldn't have that kind of issue. I don't have to hard sell the course because it's required across courses.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, so
yeah.
All Ateneans should have at least a free unit of this course. Plus another Filipino. So here in Ateneo, we have 6 units of
okay.
basic Filipino.
And this is a pain for them, or what is your feeling? I mean, is it do they take it easy, or?
I think many students would really look at it as a kind of pain, as you've said. Because yes, unfortunately, many young Filipinos nowadays would have trouble. They're Filipino illiterate, I would say, and they're not even functionally literate in the language because they really have hard time writing in Filipino, much more speaking.
When even Jessica Safra is saying that she couldn't understand parts of your book, I mean, then what about the students? Of
yes,
course,
yeah, of
yeah,
course.
It is.
Yes.
That is interesting, and but I always thought that the Filipino idea is a bit like the Bahasa in Indonesia, like Kiswahili in Tanzania.
Yes, also Sanskrit, we have that,
exactly,
and Chinese.
That's rather, you have a language.
It's a very rich language, really, and the students would just have to realize it while they're with me.
But if you look at the broad society, would you say it's the project is just was not successful building up a national language everybody is attached to?
Yes, I think that Filipino as national language would have that only in letters, because we have that in the constitution.
Yes.
But the implementation really is the saddest part of the language, Philippine language story.
Why did it work out in Tanzania or in East Africa, in Bahasa, in Indonesia?
We have this very, we've gone through a series of colonization,
yeah.
right? And
yeah.
the American colonizers were here relatively, their stay in the Philippines were relatively shorter than the Spanish.
Of course, yeah.
Right? But their impact really remains very much alive. The influence is really there.
You mean this kind of divide and rule concept on all levels, even on the language level, that the foreign language, like now English, in former times Spanish, was always important than anything local.
Yes, because I think the colonization that we experience from US is quite effective, in fact more effective than the Spanish counterpart.
That's interesting. Yes. Although it was so short.
Yes, because they were able to colonize the important aspects of our lives as a country, the most especially the economic side and the cultural side, not to mention the political. So if you have this free, I think there would be no escape to that kind of tight clutch.
All right. And is there any
and the students' weakness in the language nowadays, as they look at Filipino language as a kind of as a big part of language barrier in their students' life, attests to that kind of colonial influence.
That's interesting. So they would prefer that everything is in English.
Yes, if you would ask them, life would be easier if they could have that. So many of them, especially Ateneo students who are based in Manila or who have been living in Manila for most of their lives, are quite monolingual.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know
yes.
that.
So I think as a teacher, as a faculty member, it should be my commitment to show to them that being monolingual is a shameful thing.
I agree. It is.
It's a shameful thing nowadays, especially when you say globalization or the global era. Is described as very much multicultural.
Yeah.
But here in the Philippines, you're very proud that you can only speak and understand English. So I have to tell them that it's not something that you should be proud of. And here, part of the American colonization influence, we see English as something like a superior language, much superior to other languages. And I have to tell them that there's no such thing as superior or inferior language, but there are language of prestige, and language of prestige is prestigious because of factors that are quite arbitrary.
Yeah.
So I have to explain that to them. And well, the experience that I had in Frankfurt and other friends who had been to Frankfurt and Leipzig, they said that, oh, our European audience, they don't understand us even if we are already talking in English. So we thought that since we know English so well, that it's our key to speak to the people of the world. But the Frankfurt and Leipzig experience debunked that kind of idea. So I have to tell these stories, this kind of stories, to my students.
It's a good idea.
Yeah, that a lot of people in Europe, they don't mind English really that much. It's only us who is putting so much deal about this language.
Yeah, I think it's, of course, I mean, without English, we couldn't have talked like this. I mean, this is a fantastic tool for crossing over.
Yeah, it's a lingua franca.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's right. But of course, it's great to have a mother tongue or whatever, where you are much more creative with. But for these chaps, for these students, I mean, when they are brought up with English only, yes. I mean, it is more or less their mother tongue. I mean, it is difficult to introduce this idea then. I mean, this is hard work.
Yes, and that's why working with Annette Hogg is really amazing. Because I converse with her in Filipino, and sometimes she would insist to speak with me in Filipino, because she wants to
of course,
practice
to improve
Filipino.
Her, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, it must be really hard for a person like her who's translating with really with courage and with she likes it a lot, and then seeing that the language is not really implemented in the in the country where it comes from. I mean, that is interesting. It's almost a funny sidekick in a way. It's very interesting.
Yes, and I have to say that sometimes her Filipino is much better with some of these students.
Of course, yeah, I'm not surprised actually. Yes. Okay, I think we are 5:59. We have to close.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
Yes.